Our first session is going to be moderated by Jonathan Zittrain, and the theme is delineating the public and private. And a lot of the idea behind this session is to bring people from different fields together to talk about how, in their areas of expertise, the public and private are delineated and what kind of distinctions and definitions and concepts they bring to this area. So welcome to Jonathan. Jonathan is a professor of law here at Harvard Law School. He's one of the co-founders of the Berkman Center, along with Charlie up there. And he served as its first executive director. He's the author of The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. And so welcome, Jonathan. And I'd like the panelists for the first session to come up.
Thanks so much, Judith. Welcome to our panelists. Do I get a hug? Oh, you get a hug. It's the morning. Why not? Thank you. So good morning, and welcome to what I call yet another privacy conference. But this one is different. This one is different not because of the issues we're going to talk about, because at yet another privacy conference, what defines it is that we're always talking about these issues, but more because of the people in the room. This conference is a mashup. We have people from different disciplines and people who think about this kind of stuff full time mixed with people who don't think about it so much, or perhaps maybe this is peripheral to what they're doing, but also touches us all. And in having this mashup, I think the hope is we may be able to come to some new insights during the day, and the kind of insights that may creep up on you and club you later. It's not necessarily what business people call, when they go to their conferences, actionable items, which of course to lawyers, actionable items are things you can sue over. So again, you have some difference in opinion. So our first panel is sort of meant to represent that mashup spirit. This is almost like a lawyer, a computer scientist, and an architect walk into a bar. And here they are, and we're gonna figure out what the punchline is. And I guess just one note on my mind before we start is to realize that when you have a mashup situation, when you have people who've been studying and breathing this stuff as part of their life's work, you can, if they are indeed expert, end up having them be very much marinating in a particular vernacular or a particular way of thinking about things, and in trying to cross from one vernacular to another may be where there are lessons to learn. I think if we had, I don't know, quantum theorists or string theorists, you know, physicists, hard scientists at the front of the room, we would expect not to understand a word they were saying. If we understood what they were saying, we would want our money back, kind of thing. Here, we want to understand what people are saying, and the people who are saying it want to be able to speak at the level of subtlety for which specialized vernacular and such may be required. But anyway, this is sort of to give myself license, as I'm kind of the clueless man from Mars, on behalf of the clueless people among us, and you know who you are, to be able to ask questions as we hear from the experts among us. So that said, I wonder if we should start with Paul Dourish from UC Irvine. Paul, you've got a few opening remarks to share. And before you deliver them, tell us how you found your way to privacy as a field or subfield.
Let's see. So I've been working on areas connected to this stuff for a long time, ever since my first job was at a research center in Cambridge in England, Rangsburg Europark, which was made up roughly one-third of computer scientists, psychologists, and sociologists, and we were doing a lot of work around the use of multimedia communication technologies, and many of the and immediately running into all sorts of questions about privacy, access, and the forms of sort of the kind of participative statuses that people could have through those sort of early multimedia and ubiquitous computing applications. And it has turned out to be this topic that I can't get away from
for 20 years and started to love the bomb.
It's just, that's right, it's there. You can't really pretend that it's not, although many people manage to.
And I can't help but ask, too, among privacy scholars, there are those who, their medium is their message, they are extremely private personally. And among privacy scholars, there are those who are extremely public. They're constantly blogging about how much they care about privacy, kind of thing. I'm just curious where you fall along the spectrum and the link between the personal and the professional.
Well, let's see, probably more towards the private, but on the other hand, in the midst might be something we end up talking about. It's like, I'm not necessarily sure that blogging is a public activity. Uh-huh. It's a very carefully crafted crafted activity. It's not that I'm not on Twitter, although people always complain I'm only on Twitter at conferences.
Right.
And not that I'm not on Facebook, but then those are crafted.
Right,
crafted
right. The right question there might be, which you is on Twitter?
Right.
And the choice of which you could define public and private. And again, I suppose it's a spectrum, not necessarily a binary choice. With that, hit us.
Okay.
It's a blackjack room.
All right, let's see. There's a couple of things that I wanted to try to just to sort of throw out as starting points for some of the conversation, both in this session and later on today, coming out of some work, a couple of projects that I've been doing over several years. And the first one, the first thing I sort of want to try and talk about that's been important in a lot of the work that I've undertaken is thinking about privacy not so much as something that people have, but something that people do. So this is partly because I work a great deal with anthropologists and sociologists, and we're trying to focus on the detailed cultural practices by which privacy gets done. What is it that people are doing when they're doing private? What is it that they're doing when they're doing public? On the plane from Los Angeles yesterday, I was reading Christina Nippert Eng's relatively new book, Islands of Privacy, and she has this fabulous section where she has a list of all the things that people do as ways of keeping things public or making things public or keeping them private. My favorite one was tidying up before the cleaning lady comes, and before a dinner party, reorganizing your pile of magazines to put the Oprah magazine on the bottom and Gourmet magazine on the top. Right, she's looking at those sort of mundane, everyday practices by which privacy actually happens. But more importantly, I think there's this notion that in doing privacy, in being private, in orienting towards information as potentially public or private, these are some of the ways in which we do social relations. These are some of the ways in which social life plays out. Being in an intimate relationship, being in a family, means having a certain kind of orientation towards information as being potentially public within that group, right? It's not that alone computer scientists often take this sort of, economic model of a cost-benefit trade-off or value I get back for giving information out. That's not what's going on when people share the details of their day when they get home. So privacy as practice is the first thing I sort of wanted to focus on. And then the second one, sort of related to that, thinking about public, is to point towards some of Michael Warner's work as a media theorist and queer theorist on publics and counterpublics. And I found Warner's work very useful. Warner's focused not so much on a notion of public, but on the many different kinds of publics that are formed and that emerge, and emerge for him as a media theorist in forms of address and encounter with media objects. Publics for him is what happens in that notion of recognition of this is aimed at people like me. And as soon as I have that notion of people like me, I have a sense of myself being connected to these other sort of publicly addressed strangers that gives me a sense of myself and gives me a sense of identity that bands me together with other people. So it's a form of recognition and also a form of connection that perhaps that's much smaller than what we talk about as the public. I'm obviously a member of many different publics simultaneously, but that arises out of an encounter with media objects and or with other people, with events and with places. So the notion of publics here is something that begins to speak to a pattern of sort of complicated sameness and difference, ways that I can distinguish between different kinds of publics, ways that I recognize myself as being in some ways the same as other people. And that's a very resonant notion for me as a computer scientist because it links into the ways in which we think about infrastructure. And as a computer scientist, a lot of what we do is build infrastructure. We build technologies, we build networks, we build these things that provide new ways of connecting people. And those infrastructures, and I think of infrastructure fairly broadly here to include, practices, organizational schemes, relational databases, and all the rest of it, as think of infrastructure as things that create patterns of sameness and difference. Right? The power infrastructure is about making sure that power is exactly the same at all the places you can plug into it, but those places where you can't plug into it become very, very notionally different. And so those patterns of sameness and difference are what sort of go through all of my thinking about through these questions of public and private, but in a way that I think speaks to a much greater sort of fragmentation and separation than just a standard notion of this is private and this is public. So let me just quickly, I wasn't keeping track of the time, give a couple of examples from some of the recent projects. Skip that one and go into the others. So one of them we've been doing for a couple of years was looking at the case of parole sex offenders in California who were being tracked with GPS. And one of our interests in the context of mobile computing and mobile technologies is how do the GPS units function as a means to re-encounter everyday space? How do you think about space if you have to move through it without, for instance, coming within 2,000 feet of a public park, a playground, a swimming pool, a library, school, and so forth? Certainly not something that I could have done when walking here from the hotel this morning, since I just don't know where I am. And one of the things that becomes interesting for the sex offenders, and relevant, I think, perhaps for this conversation, is first, a reconfiguration of the scale at which public space is encountered. Even though the parole regulations say that you can't come within 2,000 feet of one of these places, it's impossible to navigate the everyday world at that level. It's impossible to navigate at the level of 2,000 feet. What becomes relevant for people tagged in this way is what are safe towns to be in? The sorts of towns that don't have schools, playgrounds, public parks. What are safe places to go where you can wander around without necessarily potentially violating your parole conditions? So scale becomes reconfigured. I think that's something that's probably very familiar to many of us in a sort of online electronics or web 2.0 kind of context. The scales at which we are connected to others become radically different than those of the sort of the encounters of everyday life in a non-electronically mediated world. And the second sort of thing, just quickly, out of that project, is to think more complicated terms about the kinds of social relations that are enacted by notions of public and private. What does it mean to be connected to people in these different kinds of publics? We actually found the word privacy to be remarkably problematic for thinking about the sex offender case, not least because the Supreme Courts of many states have ruled that privacy is not an issue here, just by fiat. But instead, thinking in terms of people's accountabilities to each other. Again, I think something that we encounter a lot in a sort of Web 2.0 online world, that is, that participation in different kinds of systems renders me accountable to different kinds of other groups in different ways. This takes on a very different kind of notion for the parole officers, who suddenly find themselves accountable for the very complicated and extremely detailed log that they have of everywhere that all of their cases go, and who suddenly find that any time that a GPS bounce causes the parolee to suddenly, momentarily, electronically appear to be in Nevada rather than California, that has to be accounted for, that has to be lodged, there's a process that has to go on organizationally. So I think in these sort of terms of accountabilities, of responsibilities, of different kinds of visibilities, of the kinds of commitments that we have to each other, we can see within this framework of many different kinds of publics and many different kinds of practices of privacy, a much richer way of thinking about the social relations that get enacted through these kinds of systems.
So, Paul, thank you for putting on the table two, and maybe more, but I at least caught two interesting concepts floating around. One, privacy as practice, not just as rule set or something. And the second, the concept of multiple publics. And the examples are extremely provocative. I was waiting to hear, given you're a computer scientist, that maybe you did the iPhone app. I mean, in comp sci, there's the traveling salesman problem. You solved the traveling sex offender problem, which would try to calculate how to get from here to there. It's like shortest route, less highways, you're a sex offender. And you click on that, it gives you the kind of Byzantine route, or it just says, you can't get from here to there. Like, sorry, there are too many parks. That would actually be a fascinating app to write and to actually imagine. People don't have to be sex offenders to download it. You'd learn a lot, actually, about the implications of that law to try to actually live your day according to those terms of parole and see how long it would have taken you to get here from the hotel across the street. I mean, how easy would it be to write that app?
Well, I see. There's actually one of the things I'm reminded of is an application called IC that Tad Hirsch and other people did, which was attempting to navigate your way across Manhattan without coming in within view of a surveillance camera. And this produces some very complicated routes.
There's the cheat switches, just put a bag over your head.
That's right, there's various strategies. Yeah. Ironically, one of the reasons we got into it was sort of thinking that there's no way to ask Google Maps what your route is from A to B without coming within 2,000 feet of one of those places, although it rapidly proved moot anyway, as we discovered that many of the subjects in our initial pool were also, as part of their parole conditions, not allowed to be online. When you right. think about it, okay. So those were not conditions. My concern as a computer scientist, I'm an unusual computer scientist, and I'm not that sort of computer scientist, unfortunately, anymore, who spends a lot of their time building these things, although a lot of products do come out of my group.
I thought that's what computer scientists like graduate students were for.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most of the graduate students we're working with on this project were criminology graduate students. But I think one of the things that is important for us is not necessarily to, not necessarily to see sex offenders as a design population, but the other one was try to think about how it is this notion of privacy gets enshrined within the kinds of technologies that we build. In particular, if privacy is sort of it does become a rule set, and if it is sort of based on predicated upon a notion of trade-off, an economic trade-off between sort of disclosure and value delivered, then a whole bunch of other kinds of things are neglected about the forms of participatory status that are enacted. So at the first conference where I presented this stuff and was focusing particularly in this notion of accountability as perhaps a better kind of term than privacy for much of what was going on, a person stood up right after me and then gave a paper, which was one of these standard systems, sort of buddy type systems, where helps you understand where your friends are when they're out for a drink of an evening. This was in Glasgow, so an evening of drinking lasts quite a long time. And one of the things that they commented was, as we found that people really didn't care about privacy very much here, and in fact, she then relayed a story where somebody was getting a lot of hassle from his mates for not having said where he was out the night before, like, why are you, who were you out with that you're not telling us this? And it was a great example of this notion of accountability as perhaps a more useful lever than privacy here. What kinds of accountability did this person suddenly find himself subject to by his participation in a system that would made it possible for people to keep track of these things? Yeah. Now, that's more my concern in terms of the design implications, not so much what would it be to build an iPhone app here, but what kind of notions of privacy are being enshrined in technologies, and how is it that they then become the basis for any of us to think about what privacy might be?
Well, that nicely brings also to bear your notion of multiple publics, that the experience of this workshop right now for people in this room could be very different, because for some people, there's a bunch of old friends here. It's like, these are my people, this is my public, is very different from somebody who may have just turned up, doesn't really know anybody. It's a totally different experience that might even be captured by public and private, and I suppose also puts on the table the notion of identity, that a public, it sounds like by your vernacular, is a group with whom you identify, and the story you told about Foursquare, Gowalla, these check-in apps, is they let you identify who your public is and exclude everyone else. These are the people with whom I identify, at which point they're like, hey, you should be in our public all the time. What, did you stop being us? Why did you not check
right.
in?
Right, and gives us another way of thinking perhaps about the ways of being private and public and the ways of being public and private as well through one's participation in those.
Very good, thank you. Laurent Stadler, did I pronounce it right?
Yes.
Ah, very good. From ETH Zurich, tell us how you came to the study of privacy in these topics.
Actually, it's a quite peripheral theme of my research, but perhaps I can show two points of contact. The first one, I worked on an architectural writer and architect, Hermann Muthesius, who studied the English house around the end of the 19th century, which is considered as an apogee in some way of the private
house. The English house.
The English house around 1890 to 90. And he brought it into Germany, and the transformation he made showed quite a different conception of how to live inside a private house. So this would be one point. The second point is that our research in the last year with my students at ETH is on the crossroad between architectural history and history of technology, and we have been working for 3 years on the threshold. So quite a physical element.
The physical threshold.
First we began with the threshold, and after that, we of course discovered that there is a lot of metaphorical and use of the threshold which has to be considered.
And by the threshold, you mean the literal boundary.
Actually, we began with this element, but if you study it and if you make a typology, it goes from air curtain to revolving door to elevator to body scanner, RFID technologies. So suddenly, there's a question.
I feel like now I'm Kramer about to ask for a stock tip. What's the threshold of 5 years from now so I can buy soon?
Oh.
Where are thresholds going?
There's a loose of materiality, so probably it will be in new medias or new technologies, I think. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that the old one are going to be destroyed. And that's actually the topic I want to present here.
Well, let's have it.
I have some slides, so
are
probably
they loaded and
it's,
ready to go?
It's better I go there.
Please.
So as I told, I'm going to present a small summary of the research we conducted with our students in seminars at ETH. Privacy has long been associated with enclosed space of the interior. This conception is revealed in expressions such as one's own four walls or in the popular demand of a roof over one's head. They convey a desire for intimacy and protection, which has come to be virtually synonymous with an interior space enclosed on all sides. This model finds its apogee in the 19th century Victorian house and its notion of privacy. There, privatus, as opposed to res publica, has definitely become a positive category. In the Victorian house, the private rooms are clearly distinguished spatially, but also by program and character. Similarly, the 19th century city is constituted on the one side by its public institution and on the other side by private houses, the first of being to the rule of the embellishment, the latter to those given by the law. But this understanding of the wall and hence of architecture as the limit between an interior and exterior space, between the private and public sphere, has been challenged over the last 150 years by a variety of architectural concepts. The open space, for example, which led not only to the fusion of hitherto individual rooms, but also to the disappearance of the clear borders between indoors and outdoors. Or the unprivate house, where the intimacy of the interior was transformed into an extimacy, a state of being permanently accessible. Or the domestic interface, which defines living space no longer in terms of its walls and roof, but as a hub of various nets of infrastructures and energy. But what is as evident as these emancipatory departures, which demanded that architecture's spatial boundaries become completely permeable to light, air, energy, and information, is that architecture has not been dissolved into a space of flow. On the contrary to the traditional wall, a range of new technologies designed to regulate the various currents of people, objects, liquids, and information have been added. Apparatuses such as turnstiles, sliding doors, and the air curtain, technical devices such as a doorbell, intercom, and chip card reader, or infrastructural amenities such as waste disposal units, elevators, and water supply. Unfortunately, you don't see it well. This would be a collection of these devices and apparatuses. Thus, on the one hand, one finds a notion regularly underpinned by theory of an open house or threshold-less space that aspires to fuse seamlessly with its environment, the broader context or network. But on the other, sought largely ignored by historiography to date, an increasing series of artifacts that allows this open-ended space to be even more reconfigured, delimited, and controlled. Best examples are the airport, a transitional space by excellence, or highly specialized building like the laboratories. What then are the implications for architecture and the related notions of privacy when the traditional forms of opening, such as door and window, cede place to an automatic revolving door, a body scanner, or an air curtain? When
when the exterior or interior walls as the traditional border between private and public is reconfigured or even replaced by a series of devices and apparatuses? And what are the implications for a human being who can no longer distinguish between an interior and an exterior and resides permanently, quite literally, in a milieu, an interim space? Three aspects may be posited here. First, the growing significance of technical apparatuses and devices throughout the 20th century prompted a radical review of architectural practice. Till recently, the traditional door guaranteed a clear boundary between interior and exterior space, the possibility of connection on the one side, and of complete privacy, as sociologist Georg Simmel put it. The proliferation of increasingly differentiated threshold devices led conversely to the fragmentation of the hitherto uniform border. It was broken down into a sequence of individual elements, each of which drew new, functionally well-defined borders in a highly individual manner. As for instance, in Diller and Scofidio's Brasserie in New York, where the guest appears on the screens even before entering the space. Actually, you see here the camera and the projection which happens inside the room. Second, given these devices' growing capacity for differentiation and individuation, the enclosed and uniform space conceived still at the close of the 19th century as a common backdrop to all possible types of relationship, architectural, social, legal, or also aesthetic, now ceded the place to an endless number of autonomous, partly overlapping, but highly specialized spheres geared to the individual purposes as of security, hygiene, climate control, or even to olfactory and optical monitoring. Challenging the hitherto obvious categories of the inside and the outside, and thus of privacy and publicity. Where and when does one enter the Prada shop in Los Angeles, one may ask. Devices are anthropomorphic, not only because they are designed by man and meant to facilitate his activities or accomplish them on his behalf, but also because they in turn shape man and his activity by prescribing certain behaviors. New technical devices herald new, differentiated, and interactive experiences of the threshold. These are punctuated by instances of recognition, passage, cleansing, or when access is assured of absolution, and so forth. They subsequently appear to break down whatever was hitherto perceived as a uniform, idealized body of the users into individual organs, each of which is compelled to cooperate on a specific task at a certain moment. A leg activates a light barrier sensor, a body shell sets off metal detectors, an iris is scanned in the biometric control, and so forth. Thus, the passage through a border is split into individual moments and hence fragments the body, whose integrity can consequently be experienced only by traversing a whole variety of distinct borders. But what, one may ask, could be the role of the architect in such a world? Today, what must be challenged is not so much the recurrently voiced notion that the liminal function of architecture is about to go down the drain owing to an endless flow of stream of people, objects, liquids, energy, and information. This is hardly a credible affirmation, given that the massive and enduring architectures currently under construction in the Western world outstrip any we have seen so far. Nor is it, on the contrary, the notion of privacy bound to the four walls and the roof that must be challenged. It can be done or not. But far more prosaically, what is at stake is the idea of the limit itself, architecturally and otherwise, as a mean of segregation, fragmentation, specialization. Anthropologist Arnold van Gennep appositely defines the difference between a border and a threshold. In contrast to the border, which can be closed to outsiders, the threshold comprises a neutral zone between the limitation. It is manifest at the territorial level as well as in urban correlation, such as a village, town, district, temple, or house. This zone decreasing steadily in scale and in degree of public impact may be declined as a landscape space such as desert, swamp, or jungle, through to single architectural element such as a gate, a portal, a door, or the physical threshold. To this, of course, we would have today to add the different threshold devices and apparatuses created by the new technologies, but also the technologies which have invaded our bodies. For a long time, privacy and public space have been defined by opposition, that is, separation. But what Van Gennep has shown is that the limit must not be divisive, but can be connective. That it is not only bound to a liminal experience, but is destined actually to transcend it. What seems at stake now is not so much a loss of privacy, but the unique necessity to constantly and publicly renegotiate the border and its consistency.
Thank you so much, and what a fantastic way in which PowerPoint actually makes what you're talking about come alive, at least for the slides that weren't washed out because of our projector, for which we apologize. But what an amazing way of explaining, for instance, how thresholds can matter and how they don't need to be defined the way you think of them, say, in that English house of you cross from one to another. So I wonder, Laurent, I hope this is a playful challenge and not too playful by half, you tell me. Both to illustrate the ways in which you show how a built space is a built space represents so many decisions by an architect, by a designer that endure, that affect the way we live our lives, and to illustrate your point that the way things are aren't the way that things have to be. They can be redesigned, these spaces. I'm curious, just to be self-referential for a moment, here's a room with people and a baby. And it's a space that is very familiar to us. You turned up for this workshop. The fact that it was in this room was like, nice burled wood, you know? Like, all right, it's a classroom. I wonder if you could take a moment and deconstruct this room, its relation to our function as a group, to our desire within this group during this meeting to be both very public and private, particularly as we're working with our technology.
You chased it away, Jonathan.
The baby just
yes,
left?
Yes.
On its own locomotion or with help?
I think because of your joke.
I see. This man will insult a baby. it was a friendly.
In public.
It was a friendly cry out. What can I say? So, more private than public. The baby tweeted, yes. But finally, an actual use for Twitter. It's for babies. We digress. The question is, what can you tell us about how the environment we're in right now is shaping how we're deciding to talk about an intellectual topic? And are there ways in which you could imagine it being reshaped that would change how we're about to talk about this topic?
Yeah, actually, this is an interesting topic because it's a typical question for church spaces. The Catholic Church had this long, narrow main space for processions. And the Protestant space has always been the space of communication. So it's much more like a theater space where there is a direct, or should be a direct contact between the preacher and its public. And obviously here we are still in such a way, we are not really discussing with the public, but we have a kind of hierarchical situation. Perhaps it's good, but we have it here.
Is this space more Catholic or Protestant?
It would be, if we have to work in such typologies, it would be more Protestant. But another interesting topic I was thinking while crossing the campus is, for instance, the difference between Austin Hall and the Science Center. And I think these are two buildings which really show this kind of difference between Austin Hall, this building by Richardson, which has a really monumental and symmetrical facade with some stairs which goes up. It's really incorporation of an institution, while the Science Center is completely open actually to the campus and to the lane, and there is not anymore such a clear boundary between inside and outside, and people walk through and use it much more as a kind of place of encounter.
So there's Austin Hall. And you were saying the place of encounter is more like the Science Center or more this?
Science
Center. And I guess it's the interior space you're talking more about than the exterior. Yeah,
but also the way the entrance is done, which is more... And so I was trying to say that the Austin Hall is a quite of traditional institution. There is clearly an outside and an inside, and then there is this porch as a real threshold place which separates in some way or connects the both. And in this building, it's much more diffuse. When do you begin to be in the building? Is it when you are under the roof? Is it when you cross the door? Or is it when you are in the main gallery in the center of the building? So I think there you can quite nicely show.
Which means you might get drawn into this building by matter of degrees. You sort of come for the little fog pool to the right,
then
find yourself under the awning because it's wet, and then you find yourself inside because you smelled the coffee.
Exactly.
And Austin Hall, you may have to make more of an explicit decision,
explicit
like the Supreme Court of the United States, to mount the stairs and open the door. That's a threshold.
We're trying to keep them out, John.
Of the Supreme Court.
Well, that's... Austin too.
In Austin, that is certainly, I guess, the message you're saying the building is conveying. Whereas
Absolutely.
This is actually, despite looking like it's Martian, more inviting.
Spatially, yes.
Spatially, yes. That's a good. It's spatially more inviting. We can't speak to the rest of it. It is the Science Center, after all. And so this room, back to this room for a moment. This is a room with big thresholds, right? This has a threshold between inside and outside, between front of the room and back, which is only the crazy people sit up front. And, no offense, we could change the thresholds here, right?
Yeah, we could, yes.
Which I guess would make it harder to hold a class, because we hear babies from far away.
Absolutely. There is one example, actually, in the Seattle library, where the upper seats are quite public, and the more you go down, the more enclosed is the space. So there were some tries to do it. And this is a typical example where I think the thresholds have been, or the architect has been working on threshold. For instance, the sidewalk is inside the building.
Yeah.
Or as you see, the auditorium is completely open on the top. And when you walk down, you come into a much more traditional.
And here you could be drawn into a lecture that you weren't meaning
to attend.
And you
can left when your child is.
Exactly.
Is
where the escalator goes, no one knows. Seems somewhat worrisome. Terrific. John, why don't we turn now to you, to John Palfrey. How did you get into privacy?
Your class, Jonathan, Internet and Society, maybe 1999.
Those were good times.
Even back then, so you started with, this is yet another privacy conference.
Yes.
But I think even in the late 90s, you were saying, this is yet another class on privacy with respect to cyberspace. Oddly, you've always seemed bored by the topic and yet always come up with more and more insights into it over time and seem to return to it.
The art of, was that a compliment or an insult? I just don't know.
Total compliment and also fun. So it was by you, and actually the struggle in a way of what to say at another privacy conference is made easy, I think, by the continued insights that you have. The idea of generativity itself, I think, builds on that. And every time you learn something new about cyberspace, you create new problems in privacy, which I think is partly why we're back here. As we build more and more of this built space or design more of it, we come up with new and more intriguing problems. And I don't think we've solved yet the design problem of how to live a balanced life as between public and private in a cyber environment. And it seems to me that's sort of core to what's here. And huge credit to Judith and Jeff Long for pulling together this wonderful interdisciplinary group to talk about it. And you said earlier, what was the punchline of the joke? Lawyers are usually the punchline of the joke, right? So you've left us for last, so I guess we're the punchline. But I think the reason that we're also engaged in this and interested in this is that lawyers on some level are also designers of spaces. I think that we like to hang out with Jeff Huang and Laurent and others because we perceive that we are designers of institutions and rule sets and so forth that make these spaces not just have low thresholds, but also have inviting environments where we can thrive, right, over periods of time. And again, I think privacy is one place where we as lawyers haven't done a great job yet in determining what that rule set ought to be like. I wanted to hit three points that I think grab somewhat what Paul and Laurent have been saying, but maybe also throw some things forward to some later sessions. The first is the importance, I think, of the human experience in this space. And Dana Boyd, I think, is the great expert on this, and we'll be hitting it later. I think her basic insight that we are public by default and private through effort or private by design is a very important one in this environment. Also key to that, the work that Dana's been doing, but lots of us also in focus groups and interviews and so forth, learning from people, both young people and older people, that baby back there and up through the oldest person in the room, that in fact, while I think many of us have the initial instinct that people don't care that much about privacy in this space, that simply isn't true. That I think we're learning much more as we live in this space, that though we often trade convenience for control, we very often give information about ourselves out. You've always pointed out in that class way back then, the CVS card or the Shaw's card that you get 30 cents off the butter, even though that might later make your insurance rates go up and so forth. We do it anyway. That we care about it in particular contexts, and trying to understand that human behavior is, I think, crucial to the story. And I think that's in part where Paul started us off with. And that's a changing set of practices. Worse and I are now doing focus groups with kids again after 3 or 4 years of a hiatus from it, and hearing them talk about privacy in ways that they clearly, at least in this tiny sample, are more thoughtful about it. I think we are coming to greater and greater recognitions about the kinds of trade-offs that we're making, and yet even in understanding these trade-offs, not making great decisions, not necessarily yet having the handholds or the tools or the means to give expression to the things that people want as our sort of desires in terms of what to keep private and from whom and what context. And again, I want to throw this forward to Dana, who I'm sure will talk more about that set of trade-offs later. The second one, I think, is sort of a classic lawyer's problem that we've dealt with for hundreds of years, which is the intersection between the public and the private. We've debated this in many respects. The sort of obvious debates over this are the design of how the Fourth Amendment works, for instance, and its analogs around the world. The basic question of when somebody, ideally in this case the state, wants to get information about you, what are the rule sets that say you can, under these circumstances, by getting this kind of a warrant in this kind of a way, and the extent to which in this environment things like the Fourth Amendment haven't been good tools for us because of the blurring of what is public and private, and also the extent to which when things are in private hands, in other words, they're held by a private player like a Facebook, the same rules don't apply. This is called the third-party exception or third-party doctrine. There are lots of ways in which our old designs of these spaces fit the rule system relatively well, but in this new environment, this much more blurry environment, those rules don't work as well, and we haven't yet done the hard work to reimagine how those protections and those kinds of trade-offs ought to get played out, particularly in a space where so much of the time it's private actors who control what are the public spaces, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about that theme. And then the third one, I think, is just to reflect on the basic notion of the systems that we've built for the internet and social media and other things that go on top of it. And sticking with the Gowalla and Foursquare and Scavenger example of the kind of check-in applications, I think the systems that tend to work best are ones that are highly interoperable with one another, right? So we don't want to have to type into 5 different systems my status update. I am in MD, Maxwell Dworkin, G115, at pound hyperpublic, sitting next to at Ethan Z, right? You want to type that once and have that broadcast into a whole lot of different systems so that if Jenny Toomey is on Gowalla Kabbalah and Dana Boyd is on, you know, Scavenger, they'll all see the same thing. And the systems that are most highly interoperable, have the most open APIs, have the most apps, those are the ones that succeed. Android passing, you know, the iPhone now with the number of installs and so forth. So we favor that most highly interoperable of systems as a design matter. And we think of that as good for innovation, consumer choice, competition, all these things. And yet that itself is one thing that gives rise to the problems of privacy in this environment, right? The extent to which we favor these things that do broadcast or, as you would say, promiscuous publication of this information across lots of platforms then leads to information seeping out of different contexts, the contexts that Dana and others say are so important. So as a design matter, getting back to these images, an image that came to my mind is the image of a break wall. The idea that sometimes what we need to have in these systems, between open systems, is places where, as between a harbor, a safe harbor, and then a, you know, crashing sea, we need places that the data can either be slowed or stopped in instances in which you actually want safe harbors for the data that sometimes may be able to connect to the crashing sea but may not, or places for the ships to pass and so forth. I don't think we've been as good about figuring out what do the break walls look like in these systems as we rush toward a highly interoperable system for reasons that are good. The innovation and generativity and so forth are good things, but I think we're now realizing the need to put up, and maybe speed bumps, to use a Charlie Nesson phrase is another way to think about it, but ways that the data flow in ways that give the user much more control about when they go from one context to the other. And I think that lots of the business models and lots of the kinds of public policy approaches have favored, you know, more data in more people's hands to throw more ads at it, to have more innovation, to spend more venture capital in it, to get more IPOs and so forth, right?
Yeah.
That's been the cycle. So to me, it's as lawyers coming back in along with designers and others and saying, no, we haven't quite gotten this balance right, and how do we do that?
It's funny because it feels like you've basically given Lorentz's talk a second pass because you're talking all about thresholds. And the ways in which, I think implicit in Lorentz's talk was the way in which breaking down thresholds tends to be good. Not entirely, not complete open space, but this is me being a lawyer, perhaps I'm misrepresenting what Lorentz says.
My argument was not about if it's good or not, it was first of all a kind of overview.
Yes.
What is happening.
Yeah, but I look at that Seattle Public Library and I say what makes it so interesting is that it has really played with thresholds and lowered them, right? I mean.
Yeah, but there are other examples, actually, like the airport, which is just incredible.
The Seattle airport?
No, the conventional airport.
Oh, an airport.
An airport as a.
Where thresholds and boundaries are extremely important.
Extremely important.
Yes. That's the Total Recall image you had.
But I was trying to say something as a normative matter rather than a descriptive one, which is to say the descriptive matter is, yes, we have lowered walls, and I think in some sense we favor lower walls. The Berkman Center itself favors low walls to have more people participate in our work or for us to learn more from others, right, as an example. Or, again, you're building, you know, the next Goala or Foursquare. You want low walls. But I think that there are costs to permanently low walls, ones that are eliminated, and I think we have to think about how we work with that.
To be able to just say one tweet and have it hit all platforms, arrested, as the person in Egypt did when he was arrested, then managed to have a lot of dominoes fall on his behalf. But then if you say something and want to take it back, it can be awfully hard to do, or to selectively release it. It maybe calls to mind back to Urs's opening example of Google Street View, which of course is also a great mix of the technological and the architectural, the landscape architectural, and our notions of private and public. And while it's only on the public street, you can imagine people would feel differently about Street View if it came up your front walk and dropped off a pamphlet and at the same time filmed its trip up your front. That's going too
trespass.
Far.
Clearly,
that's my
trespass.
Front walk, right. No solicitors if you have a camera. But I then see it being taken to the next step in a hypothetical that I heard from Charlie Nesson prior to 1999. Charlie's been into live streaming since before there were streams.
He's streaming you right now, watch out.
You know what, I think Charlie actually is relaxed because he's like, nah, someone else is streaming it at this point. It's someone else has it covered. But there was a time when Charlie, if not actually doing it, which he did, there's his recorder, he aspired to a world in which basically he could wear a hat. Instead of it having twin cans of beer with straws coming into it, His hat has two recording devices. Yeah, no, I wasn't going there. Two recording devices and a camera and a microphone. And just as he walks around, you can, you know, you can ride along with Charlie's homunculus. Like, that's the program. And see the world he sees. And he almost sees it as freedom of mind to be able to choose to do that as a person. But of course, we connect that up with what you were just talking about in your inter-op zone, and you see a world in which that can be made interoperable and part of a market, so that I can say, gee, I was curious who was going in and out of Maxwell Dworkin today, and there's some query I can shape which immediately goes across the database of people like Charlie who've been live streaming and figures out for the past 30 days who was in front of Maxwell Dworkin with a decent view of the door, more or less, and then give me an account of everything that was going on across all of their freedoms to have recorded it. And that seems profoundly weird to me. That makes the "can Google film my front walk" seem like a somewhat small problem next to the world we are building interoperably among ourselves. I don't know if you have reactions to
Amen.
That. It didn't end that with a question mark.
No. I think you said it, as usual, the teacher better than I could, the student.
You're very kind, fellow teacher. All right, before this turns into too much mutual admiration up front, let us open it up, open the floor up to reactions, questions, comments, thoughts, etc. Amr has a microphone there. I don't know if the Twitter stream is worth invoking, but we're all in a room, too, so we can speak. Jeffrey Jarvis.
Laurent, I'm fascinated by the notion of the two-way effect of architecture and our notions, our definitions of publicity and privacy. You know, and I've learned recently how the impact of the invention of the hallway in the 18th century English home, or 17th century English home, and the impact it had on the creation of a notion of privacy. So in present architecture, not only of physical spaces, but also of the web. I'm trying to turn that back around and say, how is that changing? We start by trying to impose our given present definitions of privacy and publicity onto these new systems. I'm wondering the other way around, how you think these new systems are having an impact on our definitions of privacy and publicity. Any sense?
Yes, it makes sense. Actually, the example of the 19th century, what was at stake is that these borders could be done quite easily only through architecture for the main time, through space and architecture. Actually, as you said, a hallway or a vestibule or these different spaces which make the... And now, and this is really a big issue, how much architects have to deal with these other elements, because I don't think that architecture is going to change so much as a physical space in a house, for instance. I think the main rooms are going to stay as they are, but the possibility to go into a house through different devices like internet, this is surely important thing. And I think this is also the talk Urs was saying, where suddenly, obviously with new devices, you can look into the garden.
Pick up a little bit on this, because I also find that sort of notion of liminality to be a very sort of powerful and generative metaphor. But I think, I mean, you in your own talk also sort of, you know, pointed to Van Gennep and those kinds of places from which to take sort of notions of liminality and thresholds. And one of the things that's really important in there is the social processes of separation and reintegration that are entwined with the spatial, right? And as you noted, it's not simply a spatial notion, it's a social notion as well. One of the things that, and I'm sort of struck by, you know, or inspired by the question as well, is, you know, thinking about the notion of privacy at work in the 19th century English home is, you know, not everyone has privacy in the 19th century English home, right? Exactly. Yeah. No. Exactly. I think we're agreed. I mean, you know, it's very different below stairs than it is above stairs, and that's the whole point. But I think that's really important for us to continue to bear in mind as we talk about these things, is that there's not purely technological arrangements, but also the social arrangements that it takes to give meaning to the technological. And so I worry a little about the rhetoric and language we use. I was thinking in John, when you were talking about the use even just of the word blurring, that sort of suggests almost as if a private domain and a public domain are pre-given, and that somehow we're dealing in a world, a technological environment, which is blurring a boundary between domains that exist. And I'm not sure that actually is the case here. There's always a flux in which processes of separation and reintegration take place. This is the sort of Van Gennep argument for when we carry it over, is that it's about processes of separation and reintegration. I think actually the other example you gave is really useful, right? Which is, say, all the sort of Fourth Amendment debates, because the idea of like, oh dear, we haven't figured out what the right balance is in cyberspace, suggests that there's any other domain in which we have figured out what the right balance is, which again, I'm not terribly sure that we're good at that, because you know we're always in this process, and the evolution of the of space is an excellent yeah. example for an architectural for the architectural domain. We're always in the process of reformulating what for us, for different usies at any given moment, is a balance that, yes. that works.
Now that process of reformulation, I wonder if it feels like it's happening that much more rapidly now, in the sense of, coming from the zone of actual physical architecture, there may be differing ideas of architecture as time goes on. Architects think about things differently. But you build a space, in large part, you can reconfigure it a little internally, but the space you build is the space that sits there for 20, 30, 100 years. Austin Hall, not a bad example. And people come to familiarize themselves with and then be shaped by whatever the space might encourage or discourage in their behaviors. When we now make the analogy to the online space, and I think already we found how rich the analogies are between the two, one artifact of the online space, being online and all, is its plasticity, that it can be reshaped, reconfigured all the time, that the space is a service, it's not a product, which makes it hard to even talk about it totally as a space. And when the English house is built for English people to live in, we kind of know who the customer is. When an online space is shaped for us to use, especially one for free, we're kind of the customer, but what's that famous aphorism now? If what you're getting online is for free, you're not the customer, you're the product. You're the one being sold. And if you're operating in a space like that, that can be reshaped at any time, the Facebook I have today is not the Facebook I had yesterday, because now there's auto something or other that I'm supposed to go change my settings, but I'm already bored, so I'm just going to leave them the way they are. I don't know how much those constant reconfigurations of spaces, for motives, it's almost like the builder of my house continues to get a vote. I made one choice about who would build my house 20 years ago, and that builder is still hanging around. Oh, you lost your windows. Like, sorry, it's an improvement. Trust me. Live with it for 2 weeks. It's like, I paid you. Go away. You know? And yet, they're still here. I don't know how much that constant reconfiguration plays into things.
Well, again, I suggest the constant reconfiguration is a socio-technical phenomenon, not a technical phenomenon. And it's rather like, you know, that the whole, you know, you can't step into the same stream twice. The same way, the reason Facebook today is not the same as Facebook yesterday is not purely because of what
Heraclitus foresaw Facebook.
Yes. Heraclitus 2.0. The reason Facebook today is not the same as Facebook yesterday is not purely because of what Facebook did, but also because of what everybody else and all your friends did on right. Facebook that shapes the genre of what, you know, you
it was intended for college right. students to know each other, right. but then we take it to foment revolution, that right. kind of
and
thing.
And I think John's example of the interoperable status update really nicely points to the sort of problems of the ways in which what I say on Twitter is different from what I say on Facebook, is different from what I say on Foursquare, is different from all
or at least it
things.
Was until we interoperably put them all together.
Yeah, well, as I deal with different audiences, different constituencies, and different publics, I have certain kinds of investments in yes. both the separations and the integrations of what is going on. So that reconfiguration is a socio-technical phenomenon
yes.
which the technology does change, the opportunities change, but yes. our interpretations and our understandings of what genre forms are being enacted
yes.
here are also up for negotiation.
Yes. Speaking of socio-technical phenomenon, we have these vestigial norms at the front that we shouldn't be online while we're actually on the panel, although John is pushing that envelope. While the rest of us are happily clacking away, which means there's a great level of interest in the room being siphoned into cyberspace, for which we need to build a pipe to pipe it back into the physical room. So I want to invite people not only to raise their hands if they have comments, which I actually saw two hands up, so we'll get to you guys, but also feel free to raise your hand and represent for something you saw online, which gives you the out to say, this isn't my view, but this seemed interesting to me. Here's something I want to put on the table. So I want to invite you to do that dynamically as a way of trying to reconnect what I suspect is a very active virtual space back to the physical one. Over here, Nell Breyer.
Hi, thank you very much, Jonathan. Is this on?
Yeah. It's there, dialing up.
Laurent, I was going to ask you if you could just speak very directly to what you feel the purpose of a threshold is, and a little bit to Julia's comments yesterday. She's talking about the idea of crawling and this notion in the art world of like crawling from gallery to gallery, and what the possibilities, and if there are any analogies absent or present in cyberspace where a threshold is or is not providing the same kind of function. Understand? No. Okay. Purpose of the threshold.
The purpose of the threshold. I try to show it that it's exactly this double meaning of connection and of separation, which can be dealt in many different manner. And what I try to show through this little talk is this unity of space. As it perhaps was in the English house, I'm not sure about this, has been diluted in a series of different spaces, be there physical spaces or be there virtual spaces, which interconnect in some way. I still think, I'm quite convinced that there is no destruction of the traditional architectural space, but it has been overloaded or newly interpreted through its behavior.
Is there more you wanted to come back with, Mel?
Well, I was just interested in how that translates, or what's missing when you have direct, immediate arrival at locations online, when there is a lack or a different type of experience of a threshold. Like you go.
I think the danger is a highly specialization of the threshold, as when you can come into a space where you can do only one thing. I think there's a huge loss of independence, and there it becomes in some way.
But if Nell's analogy is we kind of apparate like Harry Potter from one site to another online. A site is loading, it's taking too long, so it's like www.someothersite.com, and it's like, okay, that, you know, we'll take that away, and here's this, and it just appears. Are you asking kind of, could one imagine a form of transition that respects the idea of a threshold?
And that there's important things that the threshold provides, not just spatial, but communal and intellectual and
right.
experiential, that perhaps are radically absent in the online world. Not necessarily, perhaps there are analogies that are different. But that's why I was asking about purpose in not just a spatial sense, but in a...
How could a website be more like the Science Center, sort of luring people in gently?
Some of where you were into where you are, and where that transitional experience actually then creates a very neutral zone, which is informed by the identities of the people in it, not by the context of the space that you are suddenly arrive in. So there's really an important idea of lingering from the past, becoming into the present, then meeting with someone else who has a different past and in the present, so that that's where I feel like the notion of the threshold has incredible power, political power as well. And if that's missing, that's why I went back to Julia's comment about crawling, if there's some lack of memory in our accessing point-to-point locations online, how does that change identity, public right, all those things that you're talking about?
I was going to say, in some ways, this might be a question for Paul, because maybe to make it even more concrete, could you imagine a website where when you're on the website, there's some visual representation of where other people contemporaneously visiting the website, which you normally don't know about, right? It's like being in a movie theater with a wall around you while you watch the movie. Other people visiting, you get to see where they're coming in from. Wow, there's a bunch of people pouring in from AOL to this site I'm visiting. It must not be a cool site. I'm out of here, kind of thing. You know, that's.
Well, I mean, it's certainly interesting. I'm thinking actually, you know, as a webmasters already have access to all this information.
Correct, right? And
exactly
they could choose
come,
to.
Where, you know exactly
right.
where people come from.
Right.
This is information that's so this information that's available to some, if not to all. I mean, I think that you know, I think we have to be very careful about the importation of spatial metaphors, powerful as they are, because we you know we can't escape space or time, and so those things are powerful for us. But it's been a very long time since anybody browsed the web with only one window or only one tab, right? So I'm not just in one place, I'm in many different places simultaneously. But I do think there's a question about the appropriately historicizing what it is that's going on, both where the website came from itself and where yeah. And where people came from. Not getting very far with this, but the one thing I did want to add though is we have to recognize too that one of the power of these things is their dehistoricizing,
right.
you know, ability.
Right.
That's actually often one of the
right.
things that we're about working online. And I do worry about this idea that. That we want to eliminate the opportunities for a creative reconfiguration of space
right.
by reintroducing too many of the things that we do.
The metaphors can be both liberating and, of
right.
course, confining.
Yeah.
And it's funny, when you talk about tabs as being multiple spaces at once, in at least my experience, it's like, no, it's a bunch of stuff that I only get to visit one thing at a time. And I sometimes am like, if only I could configure my screen so that I could see multiple websites at once, like arranging windows in... And I'm like, wait a minute, that was the point of Windows 3.1. Remember there was like an arrange thing under window? Has anybody ever used arrange? Right, what is with that? It's like meant to be a fundamental function, and yet we never actually go, I think because each is too small.
You just buy more monitors, Jonathan. You've
What's
got
that?
Five monitors.
Yeah, I know, I do, I buy more monitors. That I finally solved my arrange problem, you're right, with more monitors. So I can't wait for the laptop of the future, which is like floomp, 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 and then you really, in the zone.
It's like an iPad.
David Weinberger.
So I want to ask an obvious question. On the grounds that you can't even step into the same stream once. So local...
That's not an obvious question, David.
Well...
To a philosopher,
that is a cryptic question.
No, it's not a question. It's an intro to the question, which will be brief.
Okay. You start with a cryptic thing, then an obvious
real
question.
Real architecture is always local, right? In a completely literal sense. And so it's entirely possible and reasonable to use a threshold or an ambiguous, ambivalent state, place wrong, and we see that happen. The web obviously is global. Privacy, as Judith was saying, you know, connecting, the norms of privacy have been intensely local and definitive of cultures. So is there any hope for actual privacy norms to settle down in the spaces that are put up on the global public web?
Start with the lawyer.
I was going to say start with anyone else here. There are brilliant people in the...
Fair enough. Does that mean we need to re-ask David's question because people are only sort of paying attention to it knowing somebody else would answer it? David hit us one more time and now everybody realizes they might be called upon to answer.
Given the global nature of the web, is there any possibility that, and given the intense local nature of privacy norms traditionally, definitive of local cultures, of culture, is there any hope that we will come to global privacy norms that can be counted, relied upon within spaces on the web which are inherently global?
Thoughts on that question? Oh, right
Ken Carson.
Ken Carson.
It's
working, yeah.
One thing to think about in trying to answer that is a question I was going to ask is that was touched on before is thinking about how privacy and private and public spaces are related to the function of creating communities. And I think that most communities have historically been intensely local, but now communities are being created that aren't local at all. And I'd like people to talk about the relationship between public creation of communities and private creation of communities.
Hmm. I think I still consider that a committee of the whole refinement and question. So if people have thoughts on that, just use.
John Taysom, a Harvard fellow. I think the answer to the question that David just posed comes back a bit to the presentation from Laurent. And I didn't expect to be an expert on anything today, but on English houses, I'm definitely an expert. The beginning of privateness, if you like, in the sense that Laurent was mentioning, I think was started with the chimney, the invention of the chimney, because with the chimney, you could finally have a private space. You didn't have to live in one big communal hall. And from then on, the whole class distinction meant that the servants had no privacy, and people who had ownership had privacy. They put themselves in a room. Where it touches back on David's point, I think, is an architectural one. If you could build large factories, you could dominate economically. Where that ties back to being online, I think is a very pressing problem, because it seems to me that the way we've architected the public spaces on the web mean that once again, the poorest people will have the least privacy. And I'm really curious to know what the panel think of that point.
So this refines the question of, you could see, if not global norms, a global equilibrium in which those who can afford it get some particular level of privacy respect, and those who can't, don't. Thoughts on that? Way over here.
I'm a lowly intern. But I think that the question...
Wait, did you just introduce yourself as a lowly intern? We all use names here, unless you were trying to illustrate the difference between rich and poor.
I think that the question that, to me, in like my personal experience, is more important than the creation of spaces online is the creation of spaces where people use these technologies. I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East, where internet cafes are by far the norm, and laptops and personal computers at home are extremely expensive and out of the realm of possibility for the majority of people. And I think that's a kind of publicness and privateness that is, at least thus far in this discussion, a bit absent, and something about access and capital that really changes the kind of publicness and privateness that you're creating. And I think it's, there are private forums, there are ways of making your Facebook inaccessible and accessible to certain people, and there are ways in which diasporic communities are using these to recreate the local in a globalized setting. And I think that that is worth studying, but I also think it's worth considering what I would do. Like, when I'm at the library, I feel particularly self-conscious about using Facebook, because someone might walk by and say, "You're using Facebook, you should be studying." Well, what about if you're in Syria and everything is an internet cafe and the person behind you could be a mukhabarat, a spy? I don't know if that's...
No, absolutely. And in fact, it probably has not escaped the notice of many regimes that want to achieve a certain level of Fourth Amendment style ability to surveil, but don't want to eliminate internet access entirely and don't want to count only on filtering your private connection to do it, to see an internet cafe as a way to, because you can't see the secret police, as long as there's one other person or maybe even zero other people in the cafe and you're using somebody else's machine, you can't be assured of that privacy. And as you say, you feel it enough as a privileged person in a library. How much more must be felt? But I actually should ask you back, is your experience in those cafes that it's kind of a quiet room, clack, 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 kind of the way some of those gamer spaces are? The gamers are not there necessarily to have, you know, hang out with each other, but to be online. Or is it actually a feature? People wander by, hey, what are you looking at? That's kind of interesting, and it actually fosters connection that exists among the servants that sometimes, you know, Batman sitting across the long table from his date. That was the first Batman movie, Michael Keaton. Remember that one? God, I'm getting old. But very big house, very wealthy, but very isolating, precisely because it's not a shared space. I don't know what your experience was in that cafe.
Sorry. Well, I think it's different, and I've been thinking about this a lot, specifically with the Syria example, because I would Skype from computers, and so whether or not I had black screens around, like, walls, like miniature walls around the individual computer, you're still speaking out loud. And I think that for people who in Syria who are trying to communicate with families, for example, outside, there's a privateness to the clack, clack, clack in what you're doing in the email you're writing, and then the Speech Act, which inherently sort of alters the threshold. And it also definitely depends. I don't know, there was an interesting New York Times article like several weeks ago about China and people who sleep in internet cafes. So I can only speak about my personal experience, but I think it people do play with the spaces.
Right. It actually also calls to mind Nell's original point that was described as historicity, and that you could be using the computer as somebody with a nice blue passport to defend yourself, to go, I'm visiting Facebook to see if I can get there. And then the next poor person who uses the thing after you might get pegged with your historical usage. You could see that as a problem. There is actually, there's an object called an iron key that we've been playing with, that you're meant to be able to walk up to any computer, plug it in, boot from this USB key, and use it totally privately, regardless of what's on that computer. Whether or not that's privacy or just security theater is another question. Paul, you've been wanting to get word for us.
Yeah, well, I wanted to pick up on this stuff, mainly because one of my students has been doing a lot of work on with new media activists in China, and actually started off looking at World of Warcraft players in China. And I think some of the examples that come up there really go back to one of the premises of David's question, right? The web is global, but your encounters with it are always local. They're always happening in particular kinds of places. For the Chinese World of Warcraft players, many of whom do go to public spaces to play alongside other people, not necessarily with other people, but near other people, and that's important to them. One of the things that's fascinating is they're playing World of Warcraft, they're playing an American game, and they know it's an American game, and it comes from an American company, but they also talk about it importantly as a Chinese game, because for them it fundamentally embodies the principles of Guanxi and sort of the shared practice, of shared commitments, of sharing and mutual responsibility, and they say, this is a Chinese game. It has Chinese values built into it. So your encounter with these things was always intensely local. And so it does bring to go back to David's question, you know, about what kind of expectations do we have for privacy norms. Well, they're certainly not going to be right global agreements about what happens, and they don't even necessarily need to be, given that even in this sort of global cyberspace, your encounters with it and the actual practices always happen in particular places for particular
which in
people,
turn
in particular
can be
moments.
A feature as much as it is a bug. A federated system where you can choose the communities and the norms you want to subscribe to would be there.
Where those global practices are opportunities for you to reimagine yourself and your own position in the world.
Please join me in thanking our panel for getting us off to a great start today.